Welcome to another episode of Comedy Wham! Presents with me, your host, Valerie, and sometime co-host, Miss Purrington. ComedyWham.com is your place to go for features about all Austin comedy. We bring you articles and podcasts featuring the best in Austin comedy in all its shapes and formats. Launched in 2016, the podcast project brings you funny people and their stories. As a fan, I like to delve into a comic's background and motivations, and we'll usually take a detour along the way. Consider the interview a way for you to get to know the folks that make the Austin comedy scene one of the best in the country. Today, I sit down with one of the co-hosts of what I affectionately call the best worst open mic in town, Love Goat Open Mic on Saturday nights. He recently took over as the host for Bubble and Squeak at Brentwood Social House on Friday nights. And as far as I'm concerned, having attended the recent Austin edition of Kill Tony, he was the only qualified person to have his name pulled on that stage, to do his minute on the stage. And I'm just very excited now. So now, Comedy Wham! Presents Andrew Wagner.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome.
As far as I'm concerned, Love Goat's just the worst open mic.
Well, through no design of my own, I just literally sat down with your co-host, Sam Castillo.
Oh, yeah,
perfect. I was like, oh, I should have probably said, hey, do you guys want a carpool? But then you would have been he would have been subject to the cat allergies even longer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I didn't say that, but you know, we spent the start of that episode talking about my description of that as the best worst open mic.
He was just here a few hours ago then?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Yes. So I'm like, oh, that's great. I just got both co-hosts on the same day. Your episodes aren't coming out at the same time.
Right. Well, yeah, shatter that illusion for the listeners.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about the joy of that open mic. And he shared the news also, but we can get into that later. But I like to start these off with an icebreaker question.
Okay.
And that is one word to describe your past.
Ooh, I think stuffy is a good, if we're getting into the whole,
stuffy
childhood, just a very,
wow.
Very, you know, I joke on stage about coming from a Christian conservative home, and it's true. Mm-hmm. My parents aren't like, you know, they're not like right wing nut jobs, but they're like very, connected to their values. They both grew up in kind of rural Pennsylvania and.
Okay.
They're connected to that kind of old school way of life. So it's not a big, loud, jokey family. Mm-hmm. But well, it is a big family, but it's not a jokey family.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
Okay. I think that may be a first of the past words. Stuffy. So we talked about this beforehand because when I was doing my research on you, a lot of times it would come up, you'd be described as coming from Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, coming to Austin, and there's a stop in between there.
Right, right.
How long were you in Oklahoma?
So just the 4 years I was in school. I grew up in Plano outside of Dallas, and then I went to the University of Oklahoma, and when I graduated, I moved straight to Austin just to do more stand-up, yeah.
Okay, so I had my chronology completely flipped. You actually left Texas to go to that state's college. This interview is now over.
No. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Okay. So now that I understand the chronology better, I would have asked you this anyway, but do you, given your family background and dynamic, do you have any early comedic memories?
Of us watching comedy in the house?
Anything that, if you think back about your childhood, a moment where, like, something was funny to you.
Yeah. I remember when we had just moved to Texas from Pennsylvania, we were visiting my elementary school, and there was, like, a truck there with so-and-so tutoring services. And I was like, oh, what's a tutor do? And my mom was like, yeah, they teach people. And I said, teach people to toot. And
oh my God.
That was, it just clicked, and there was like that little risk of, oh, am I going to say it? And then I said it, and my parents laughed. It was a huge payoff for an otherwise not a lot of jokes like that.
And oh my gosh. Do you know that joke is like so perfectly suited to, have you done Laugh Darn It?
I've not, but oh, I do like should, the, yeah. I do like the format. Yeah.
I think you need to get on that show and just have that one in your back pocket.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good one.
Maybe punch it up a little bit for my 8-year-old writing. But.
Right. Oh my gosh. That's great. Did you have performance in your background at all in school?
No, I was in the, church choir. Well, yeah. So yeah. I was in the church choir from, you know, 2002 to 2012 when I graduated high school. And we would do these, they're called choir tours. We'd all get on a bus and drive through the country and stop at different churches and sing. And when I had the opportunities, I would do solos and stuff in that. But I, so a little bit of performance in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So given that you had that great zinger, you know, with the tutor.
Sure.
Is that something that you kept doing as like just cracking jokes?
Yeah, it was always kind of second nature. It was always with me, just being zany and kind of idiosyncratic with my family's whole orderly and quiet nature, and had weird friends, and we'd all draw cartoons and. So yeah, lots of silliness, despite you know. And I don't want to make my parents sound like they're horrible, rigid people. They're they're
gotta
lovely.
Laugh, so that's, yeah, I mean, if she,
basically
giving you the death stare, then maybe she.
No, they laugh a lot, but they're just not comedy fans necessarily. Like I can remember, you know, one time in my household where, anyone was watching stand-up comedy. I remember my dad watching one Cosby special. But other than that, there's not comedy fans necessarily.
Mm-hmm. What did you go to college for?
Creative writing.
Right. Okay.
Went out of state for
that's funny.
A substandard English degree.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do with that degree?
Yeah, so I went to college, and the only career I had in mind was I wanted to write TV shows. When I was, early teenage years, I always wanted to be the profession that I was watching a TV show about.
Okay.
So I was really into Scrubs, was the first comedy I was super into. And I wanted to be a surgeon because I thought, if you're a surgeon, you hang out with your friends and make jokes all day. And I didn't. And one day my brother was just like, you know, people write that stuff, right? And I was just he kind of guided me, like, I think something like a WikiHow article on how to be a TV show writer. And I was like, oh, that's the job. That's all. So I went with that in mind, and I started stand-up comedy with that in mind. And
so where did you start stand-up comedy?
I did my first open mic in Dallas right after my freshman year of college. I was home for the summer, and I just made it a goal that before the summer ended, I wanted to do it. So in late July, I went to Backdoor Comedy Club in the Doubletree Hotel at 75 and Carruth. And I went up and did like 30 seconds. And
what?
Oh, yeah, I was so nervous. Oh. I still have horrible stage fright, but I just kind of muttered some stuff.
Yeah.
And I think some people in the crowd started responding, and I went, okay, that's it for me, gotta go.
Oh, man.
It was rough.
It's so funny to me to explore, you know, especially when people have really bad first-time experiences, what makes them go back a second time. Like, for me, it's more interesting to ask, why did you go up the second time instead of why did you go up the first time?
Because if
you've had a terrible experience, it's more interesting about why you would want to subject yourself to that again.
No idea. I had it was probably like 6 months to a year before it stopped. So I started when I was 19. I'm 25 now. I five and a half, almost 6 years of doing this. And it took me a year to finally breathe on stage, actually talk into the microphone, look at the audience. Yeah. And so I was really, maybe as a lot of young open micers are, I was disillusioned about what it was going to be like. Because I had never really watched stand-up comedy. I'd definitely never seen it live by the time I went and did my first open mic. I had just read that all these TV show writers from shows that I liked started as stand-up. So I was like, oh, I'll give that a shot. And in my head, and this is so embarrassing, I thought I was going to go and there'd be an agent in the crowd and I'd be picked up and I'd be like, phew, launched into a writer's room and I wouldn't have to go back to school. It was this whole big fantasy I had. And then as soon as I got on stage, the glass shattered and I was like, okay, I just want to be able to do 3 minutes well. And so that, it was like, my expectations were as far high as they could be, mm-hmm. and then they were instantly yanked into reality, and I was like, okay, I just want to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. And so then for the next couple of years after that, stand-up took my full focus, and because it is such an impossible task to be like, okay, I just want to do this well.
Yeah.
Does take a long time.
We have a guest now.
Is this Miss Purrington?
Yes, this is Miss Purrington.
She's getting on mic.
It's like, you're either creating allergies for somebody or you're just going to participate. Yeah. You said you waited 6 months or more before you went back.
I probably waited a month. So
okay.
After that, I did my first open mic and then, a week later, went back and did it again, okay. and it went even worse.
But oh, no.
I did the full time,
uh-huh.
And then I went back to school, and there was like maybe a month, but there was this student comedy contest coming up.
Ah.
So I started scoping out the open mics on, you know, Bad Slava or whatever. And there were a couple weeks of just going to an open mic and finding out that it had been canceled 3 years ago.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No lastgasp.org.
No, yeah. And then there was just on campus corner at the edge of, you know, the OU campus, there's a restaurant called Othello's Italian Restaurant. They had an open mic. And it was 21 and up, but the bartender for 2.5 years let me come in underage, and probably shouldn't put him on blast like that, but come in underage. And yeah, so I started going there weekly.
Mm-hmm. Jumping way, way ahead, but knowing what you know now about performing at open mics, just comedy scenes in general, how does the open mic scene in Oklahoma compare to Austin?
It's smaller for sure, but it's Oklahoma has a great scene. Oklahoma City and Tulsa both are strong scenes that, are, you know, just smaller. I think proportionally there's as many good comics there as there are here. I mean, people are funny wherever, you know, the resources aren't as much and there's not as close a connection to, I guess, the industry at large, but there are people there that want to see shows, and there's people that want to do shows, and so yeah, there's a lot of freedom in that.
Yeah,
that there's not really that much going on.
What got you from Oklahoma to Austin?
So I'd come down here with a friend to do Sure Thing and some other shows and liked the scene. Mm-hmm. And my girlfriend at the time was coming here. I think that's a common Austin story. A lot of people, it's a great breakup city.
Oh.
So I think a lot of people come to Austin and with someone else and then settle in on their own and stay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you knew about Sure Thing, but did you know how good of a comedy scene?
Yeah. So I guess my introduction, I mean, you know, Austin, I had a lot of friends from high school, of course, who went to school here, and Austin's reputation as an arts and entertainment city is, you know, big enough that they know it, Oklahoma and beyond. And I didn't know the details, but a few months before Sure Thing, Mac Blake and Duncan and Brendan came and did a show at this weird church coffee shop that we did comedy in. And, you know, Mac especially just blew us all away. And so just, wow, I thought he was like at all the open mics and was just like a regular Austin guy. And now I know he's,
he's quite good.
Yeah, yeah, quite good. But yeah, and you know, all three of them, it was a great show.
What was your first open mic here?
Ooh, Banter with Bogart on.
I haven't heard that one.
You haven't heard that one?
Uh-uh.
It's been through a couple different venues now. This was when it was at Austin Ale House on West 6th.
Okay.
And yeah, it was wild. I rode my bike down there from West Campus in August, and I get there and I'm just dripping sweat, and I go up to Brian and he's like eating, you know, like pasta, shrimp Alfredo pasta. And I'm just like, oh, hey, I'm here for the open mic. And he's like, okay, get away from me. And there's this giant 17 top table right in front of the microphone stand. And eventually Brian gets up and is like, okay, folks, we're going to be starting a stand-up comedy open mic in 10 minutes. And then the lady at the head of the table just goes, oh, no, 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 I can't do this. Gets up and just closes out the whole table. The waitress comes up to Brian and it's like, thanks a lot. You just cost me $400.
Oh, gosh.
And that was the last Banter at Bogart.
Oh, my God.
Banter with Bogart.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And my first open mic in Austin.
Wow. Yeah. And by that point, you had been doing stand-up how many years?
I guess 2.5, 3 okay. years.
Yeah. All right. So that's kind of when you start hitting a stride. But you're essentially relearning because you're doing it in a new setting and different audiences.
Definitely.
Different peer group. Mm-hmm. How long before you started feeling like you were settling into first managing the nerves that mm-hmm. you'd had. I mean, by then, 2.5 years, were you still trying to manage those?
Oh, or? Yeah, I'm still managing those now. I'm definitely a very anxious person. Yeah. But the nerves, it was a whole new type of nerves because it took me 2 years to get settled in and comfortable mm-hmm. with all the people. You know, the first 6 months to a year that I was going up in Oklahoma and just getting no laughs. I was also just not talking to anyone at open mics. I would go and sit alone in a corner. And I was like one of those types of comic where, you know, my name was like a punchline. When somebody had bombed, it would be like Andrew Wagner had a better set than you. And I was bad.
Wow. Oh, man.
So then finally, I get the ball rolling, and I'm accepted into the friend group. And it kind of took the whole time I was in Oklahoma to feel that comfortable in Oklahoma. And then mm-hmm. I moved here, and it was a full start over. And so I kind of had to, like, get over those nerves again of, you know, mm-hmm. getting into the friend group and talking to people at open mics. And probably took 6 months to a year again to feel fully integrated yet.
Yeah. How would you describe your preferred style of comedy?
I don't know. That's a tricky question. When I started, I thought I was kind of like a surrealist. I would tell these like weird stories that's all, I think, a little, self-flattery for the time. You know, I thought it was, you know, I think when I started comedy, I had all these ideas for making something different. Like, oh, I'm making something brand new. And as you get better at it, you realize the importance of using what's already there and working inside the mold of the art form more and like using the conventions that are there because they work.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think my stuff, I would describe it just more as like autobiographical. It's I try to tell true stories and kind of integrate that with the way I think audiences perceive me, which is this like Boy Scoutish, you know, choir boy, which is I was in the Boy Scouts and the church choir. So,
do you write on stage or do you write off stage to perform on stage?
Mostly off stage, okay. And I wish I had this. Some people, I feel like, write so thoroughly off stage that when they take it to the stage, mm-hmm. there's no issue of it working or not. And so they, over the course of a month, if every, you know, if they do, 15 open mics in a month, they won't try as many new jokes, but the ones that they do write are going to be finished start to finish. I'll start with kind of like some bullet points and then but it's never ready until I've done it. And so I'll start a lot of stuff on stage that dies easily. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, I'd say 75% off stage. And then that 25% really determines whether I can keep it long term or not.
Yeah. Can I go to the Kill Tony set that
sure,
you did?
Sure.
Because, I mean, for what it's worth, I'm glad you described your work that way because it felt that 60 seconds felt very off the cuff. But I know this probably hits you wrong because you probably have worked on that material mm-hmm. in many ways. But I think in some ways it's good when something feels like it's off the cuff. And you have to with it for anybody that doesn't know, the Kill Tony premise is you get 60 seconds to deliver a set. And 60 seconds, if you've got a lot of material or if you've been doing comedy a while, you know that 60 seconds is really, really short. Mm-hmm. And if you're a one-liner comic, you know, you can do it fairly easily. But if you're more of a longer story comic, you have to work really hard to get punches down. So what I remember of your 60 seconds is it was a lot of quick punches.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have observed of your comedy, like out in the real world, is it's more observational, more, you know, longer telling. So I guess maybe it was just you were forced into this 60-second mm-hmm. format, and so you were able to do the quick punches.
Yeah. So I do think a lot of my a lot of people's jokes are set up punchline.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Stephen King who said you can tell any good story in 5 pages. And so any joke, I think, you know, even if you take someone like Mike Birbiglia, who's kind of, I think, the flagship storytelling comic mm-hmm. right now, is still kind of a one-liner comic. And, like, if you listen to the jokes in there, they would work in 60 seconds or less.
Yeah.
I just kind of plucked the mm-hmm. setup and punchline.
Yeah, yeah. How was that experience for you? I've only had one other comic that's been a Kill Tony graduate, if you will.
Sure. It was nerve-wracking.
Yeah. I remember talking to you after.
Yeah. So we didn't have tickets to the show. There were a handful of us that showed up just hoping to get on. We didn't have tickets, so we weren't in the showroom itself. And they were feeding the audio out to the small room by the bar mm-hmm. where we were all sitting. But about 20 minutes into the show, the audio cuts out completely. And we're just kind of sitting there in the dark. And so John, the door guy, lets Allison Voidovich stand in the doorway. James Krott is in the hallway past the bathroom.
Oh, wow.
And the rest of us are back at the bar. Uh-huh. And so we have this kind of like
the telephone,
know, can on a string.
Yeah.
and so at a certain point, I just forget about the show. I'm like, I'm not getting on. And mm-hmm. I'm just sitting there at the bar talking to Clayton Blackstone. And then Krott turns, Wagner, you're up. And I just jump out of the stool and sprint, which is, maybe 100, 150 feet. I don't know. And so I was between that and the nerves, I was completely out of breath when I got on stage.
Yeah.
But once I got in and told the first joke and got the first laugh, I relaxed a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it was crazy. I mean, anytime you get to be up in front of a full main room at CAP with, you know, that's the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I was in the audience the entire time. So you were by far and above, and you were the only comic that went up on stage. There were a lot of, this is my first time.
Yeah.
Types.
Well, so in the lobby after the show, there were a few people that came up to me and were like, that was so good for your first time.
Oh my God.
And I was just like, oh, thank you.
Oh, well, you know, you could just, yeah. Yeah, that was my first
time. Yeah. Yeah. This is easy.
That was it, having a conversation with Tony Hinchcliffe, the top young rising comedian.
No. Yeah. I felt like I was out of it for that. I was just kind of like looking around. There was so much on stage, and it's like, you know, the fact that Doug Benson was there, who's, you know, I feel like a household name, and it was just completely overwhelming. Yeah. I couldn't, so I, you know, tried to riff in where I could, but I don't know if I, it was overwhelming for sure.
It was fun to watch, you know, it was fun to root for you, and it was definitely something that's pretty cool to have in your, in your resume, your credentials.
Yeah.
Even for 60 seconds.
My main credit is an open mic.
Glorified. But it's, you know, what does he call it? The top live podcast of the world.
Yeah, the number one.
So, you know.
Yeah.
You were on the number
He's
one.
Very Trumpish in his description of
it's like how many
data
times can he drop that in an episode? Yeah. So have you gotten, there's a comic that I listen to, and any time he has a guest on, he says, oh, you're about to get the bump, you know, from being on my show. And he says it very tongue in cheek, but do you feel like you've gotten the
Kill Tony bump? It was a very small bump. Yeah, it was maybe like 11 Twitter followers. One guy that responds to every tweet I do.
Oh, gosh.
And surely I've lost some of them now. Yeah, there was a little bump, but, you know, nothing wild.
It is fun to put a piece of this together, because I was doing my research and I was looking at your tweets, and we'll give you the chance to talk about or promote your account at the end. But like, I was reading your tweets, and I'm like, you're very, very funny with your tweets. And the fact that you're a creative writer by background, it's like, oh, that's why these are so funny. Like, there's just something, your ability to write the short and quick, like, punchy stuff. I'm like, oh, well, of course, if he's got a degree in creative writing.
Yeah. I feel like the thing that helps me most with that is, so for my job, since I've graduated, I've mostly done copy editing, like grammar and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the main thing you're doing is correcting, you know, people write the way they talk, and we talk in a passive voice, but so the main thing I'm always doing is correcting stuff into just a straight subject verb object, and thinking of the shortest way to say stuff.
Yeah.
And the most direct way to say stuff. And that honestly helped once I started thinking in terms of word economy and where to place what ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of this abstract skill that you can't really quantify in any way. There's a million different ways to write any sentence or any joke. But I feel like it's really helped me settle into what I like to do and what works for me.
Yeah. Have you hosted other shows besides The Love Goat, or actually, how did you being a host of Love Goat happen?
So one night after doing, you know, those nights at Love Goat where the booths will be completely empty, and then there's a smattering of comics that starts right at the corner of the bar, and goes back to that hook and ring game. It was one of those nights, and, you know, I had a completely silent set, and right after, Nick Savarino, the former host, pulled me aside and was like, I mean, I'm done with this. Do you want to take it? You guys want to mind? I don't know. Suddenly he's Jay Leno. But yeah. And Sam Castillo was the first person I thought of. And he's like, yeah, I was thinking of either giving this to you or Sam. And so I was like, well, you can give it to both of us. Yeah. And that was two South Bys ago.
Yeah.
So coming up in this March will be our last...
Your last hurrah.
Yeah. I think Nick and Nikita did it together for 2 years.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I started coming to that mic after she must have passed, you know, the crown.
We'll carry it on. Mm-hmm. No worries. Love Goat will. Love Goat's going to outlive all of us.
So you unequivocally just call it the worst open mic.
No, I mean, also affectionately. Yeah. I love, you know, I honestly love doing it. Yeah. It gets nutty. But sometimes there's really great nights. And it's, you know, it's like any other open mic. And it's nice to have that service to the community. I mean, there's not a lot of other long-standing open mics on Saturday nights. I mean, people start them every now and then, but they always seem to be short-lived, but the Love Goat's always there. So even though it is bad, there's not a lot of other open mic stage time on Saturday night. Yeah.
What do you get out of that open mic?
So when I took it over, it was kind of around that 8 months to a year that I'd been in Austin, and I was just kind of on the edge of, you know, being comfortable with everyone as my peers and, just by my nature, like even when I was on shows or at open mics, I kind of, you know, disappear into the background or, you know, go, you know, leave without really talking to anyone. Yeah. But that helped me just be a lot more present in the scene. And, you know, when you're bringing people up on the stage, it helps them know who you are and then you know who they are. And, because a lot of times you just see people's names floating around, but you never put a face to it. And, so yeah, if anyone's feeling like they're on the outskirts of the scene, host an open mic for sure. Because it, one, shows that you're like putting in the work to be, you know, you're giving your time to kind of pay this tax to be a part of the community that's otherwise, you know, unregulated. It's anyone can sign up to be on the thing, but to be a part of the community, I do think you need to contribute. And, so that's what I got out of it.
Before you started taking over, or before you've taken over the Bubble and Squeak, had you done any other hosting?
Yeah. I had hosted Double Barrel with Hunter Duncan and Jared McCorkle. And it was a... The joke was that there were more hosts than there were comics because we would have two comics, each of them do 30 minutes. So yeah, we hosted that all together for a while. And in Oklahoma City, I hosted a show called The Golden Hour with Harper and Andrew, with my friend Harper Bodorf, who now lives in Brooklyn. And yeah, it was like a weird kind of Chris Gethard show style talk show, but with weird sketches and different, you know, comedian or musical guests. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Haven't heard Chris's name in a while. I talked to Brett Davis, who's really close to Chris.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So how did Bubble and Squeak come about?
Just
hey, it's
yeah. Jared's like, I'm done.
I haven't been to that showcase. What's unique about that show?
It's in kind of this just quaint little coffee and tea house, and they serve, it's a, you know, European style, so they have crumpets and tea, and it's very English.
Prim and proper.
It is prim and proper. And then you know, Pat Dean will do 30 minutes of comedy there. There are some people that come every month and they're great. It's, and then it's kind of an older demographic, just the Brentwood neighborhood is, but they're good. They're good people. They're, good comedy audiences in there. But it's definitely like a family establishment. They have, you know, kids' toys all over the place. And
so do you have to do clean?
No, that's the thing. It's, that's what makes it unique. Uh-huh. Is it's, you know, anything goes, but it is, where you're, you know, doing your dick jokes, a child was just playing. So you just have to keep that in mind. It's,
Oh, what do you want to do over this coming year?
So I've been trying to make a push back towards script writing. Mm. So I have a spec script that I wrote that I want to finish up and submit to the Austin Film Festival, along with hopefully an original pilot. So yeah, focus on writing some more.
Yeah. Do you do anything else? Do you do like sketch or improv?
Yeah. So Sam and Harrison Hammonds all signed up for a Fallout sketch writing class together.
Okay.
And so we're just in sketch one. Mm-hmm. And it's been a lot of fun. It's another thing that helps just a way to think about writing differently. Mm-hmm. And it serves your stand-up well to think about stuff in terms of, you know, a story arc and a character change. And mm-hmm.
You said you just started
that class? Yeah, we're about halfway through the class right now.
So have you already started seeing changes from taking the class into how you write your jokes?
Yeah, it's reinforced a lot. You know, mm-hmm. So the creative writing background, I basically majored in writing beach books. So I studied a lot of story in college, and but it's just helpful to reinforce that and apply it to different styles of writing, and you know, kind of makes me think about the way I structure my stand-up act. If like I'm the protagonist, mm-hmm. what change is the audience supposed to see in mm-hmm. in me by the end of the set? And it's not, you know, a clear cut thing, but it's just something to think about.
Do you think that further down the road you're going to be more into writing than performing?
Yes. Yeah. I'm planning my escape from performance. Okay.
I have to tell you, because I've talked to a lot of people, and that's the vibe that I get, is like, you'd really like to just focus on writing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so other people want to focus on writing too?
No. Like, that's the vibe I get from you.
That, yeah.
As opposed to, you know, performing, being on that stage, it feeds everything. I love it. Like, for you, writing keeps coming up.
Yes.
And, you know, sure, there might be some interviews where I spent time talking with somebody about the writing process that they have, but like mm-hmm. you just brought it up without me prompting. So I just have that read.
That... Yeah. So the goal hasn't changed, even though I have gone on this almost 6-year detour now. I still want to write for a television show or, mm-hmm. you know, even, you know, if I'm really fantasizing, but I'd love to like run a show or, but yeah, it just seems like my interests and my skills line up well to the, like telling stories and structuring, stories that way. And, so yeah, that's the goal is I think I'll always do stand up, but I don't necessarily see myself as a, you know, like a big headliner or a touring act or being on camera. Cause it really does just wear it. I love stand up when it goes perfectly, but, I just don't have that. I think like a assertive extroversion where I can just really, where I really thrive in front of a crowd like that, even though I do like it. It's just long-term.
Well, you know, as with anything, it's easier when you get the positive
reaction
and response. So 6 years you've been doing?
Yeah, it'll be 6 years this July, I guess.
Okay. All right. So have you started having that, especially if you want to do television writing, have you started thinking about, you can't get a television writing job in Austin?
So yeah, I will, I guess, need to move to Los Angeles at some
point. Well, I guess I didn't want to put it in that way, but like, I'm just more asking, have you started thinking about that mental calculus of, okay, if I want to keep down this path, and if writing for a TV show is really what I want, have you started thinking about where you want to be?
Yes. And Austin is a good place to be. You can write from anywhere, which is an advantage, because you can't really perform from anywhere. You have to go to where the people are. So when I first wrote this spec script, it's a Bob's Burgers script, I wrote it 6 months ago and submitted it to this thing called NBC Writers on the Verge, which is just a just talent infusion workshop. And nothing came of it. I didn't get into the program, but it kind of got the ball rolling, and I started looking at other NBC has one, obviously, and Nickelodeon has an annual spec script submission, and Austin Film Festival takes spec scripts and originals. So the path from here is to work on that independently and submit, and just to throw my hat in the ring and maybe get plucked by someone that can put me in touch with the right people.
Yeah. Is it more nerve-wracking to go through that than go up on a stage?
No. You just attach the email and then forget about it. And it takes 3 or 4 months for them to get back to you. But
how long has it taken you to write it?
I wrote the whole thing over the course of a month. So once you get everything fleshed out, the writing, it's the mapping and the brainstorming that I feel like takes the longest time. Like, okay, what are they going to do and how are they going to do it? And is it going to make sense? But once you just sit down and write it all from start to finish, that's almost just data entry. You just have to, if it all exists in your brain, you just got to get it down on paper.
Okay. So you've managed to make writing sound really easy.
No, it's horrible. It's so hard. I never do it.
I don't know. You're making me think like, I did this one and that one.
Well, and so then the challenge comes in when you haven't finished the brainstorm, but you have to put it on, and it's just this standstill of like, okay, something has to happen, but all these, just put any combination of letters and spaces down, but it's like, these look weird and sound bad. And so it's definitely grueling.
And is it something that you prefer doing by yourself, or do you like to get the feedback?
I definitely like the feedback. The writing, I did on my own, but as I was coming up with the idea, I was telling it to as many people as I could and explaining, the three storylines. And and then now that I finished it, I have sent it to a few, people just around town to read it and give me notes. So it's not a totally insular process.
It seems like you have a great confidence about your writing. Like if I maybe this is the converse of, you have battled your fears of being on stage, but you make it sound like for you to write and brainstorm and submit your own personal, like, this came from my brain onto the written paper, like, you have great confidence in yourself with that.
And yeah.
To me, that process sounds mortifying.
Oh, really?
To submit, like, your own personal writing to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And just, either wait for the silence or
And it is definitely scary, but you're so much further removed from, if you bomb at an open mic, you're looking into the eyes of the people you're disappointing.
<That's true. laughs>
But the worst thing that can happen with these submissions is you just don't hear back. And that, can be grueling too, just like anyone that's been through a job search process dealing with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to make it sound like it's been a breeze and that, like, I do, I know, I, it, most of the fear for writing just looks like procrastination. You know, it's, if you're afraid of it, it's so easy to put it to the side. And I am often afraid of doing it and avoid it. And then that's why it's helpful to have these deadlines where it's like, okay, if I really do want to do this, I have to finish this this week. And yeah, just shoot your shot. Get it.
Get in there. Well, good on you.
Oh, thank you.
Braving that. Is it, we're gonna start winding down. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to talk about, promote?
No, not off the top of my head. We have
okay.
Bubble and Squeak at Brentwood Social House every last Friday of the month.
Okay. Oh, I had it that it was weekly. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it'll be the 22nd this month.
Okay.
And Jared will actually host it this month. Oh. I have a different, have another show that night, okay. So.
All right. Well, let's get into the last question.
Cool.
You ready? One word to describe your future.
Right now, uncertain. For all the things I want to do and that I fantasize about doing, the reality is that a lot of it doesn't work out for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So whatever, when I'm at my most zen, and, you know, this is a rare occurrence, I'm focusing on, well, the goal is to connect with people through stories and humor. And if that's as a television show writer, that's perfect. That's the dream. But, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can do that. So that, for my future, I just like to continue doing, just getting better at this and see what I can make of it. But trying not to have anything too hinged on success and entertainment, because it is such a shot in the dark. And
right. So. Yeah. No two people have the same path to a particular thing.
Right. And there's a lot of ways you can utilize the, you know, aptitudes of being funny. So I just like to continue focusing on that, because that's the certain thing. The uncertainty is where I'm going to do it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is a wrap on Comedy Wham Presents. Andrew Wagner, tell us where we can find you on social media. Promote that Twitter account that I praised.
It's at Friendly Ol Wags. That's Friendly and then Ol, O-L-E, and Wags, W-A-G-Z. And horrible for search.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll change it.
Well, you know, I love her dearly, but it's, you know, it's no poop tampon, right?
That's true. So. That one sticks in your brain. A nice plug for Ariel Isaac Norman.
Shout out to Ariel Norman for her Twitter account. Okay, and you said you've got a Bubble and Squeak show on which?
February 22nd.
All right, fantastic. We hope you have enjoyed learning about how Andrew got to be the comedic genius that you heard today, just as much as I have. Be sure to visit comedywham.com and give us a follow on Twitter and Instagram at comedywham, and like our Facebook page. You can listen to past interviews on iTunes or your favorite podcast player, and please review us while you're at it. This has been Comedy Wham Presents. Andrew Wagner, I'm Valerie, and that's been funny. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. This is great.